That was a lovely sting. That was far too mellifluous to be a sting. That was more a balm, wasn't it? It was more a healing ointment. The Rachels is the name of the group, and the track is Forgiveness from their CD. What? Selenography. What on earth does selenography mean? You must find out for me. Well, ladies and gentlemen, at the end of the 19th century, Christian pundits were confidently predicting that the 20th century would be the Christian century, where my mob, the atheists, were thinking that religion of all sorts was going to sputter out and leave synagogues, temples and cathedrals as little more than museums. But at the time, of course, the Western world was at the height of its imperial powers. Missionary activity was booming in Africa, Asia and South America as the various branches of the Christian church sought to promulgate the glad tidings. Who could then have realised that the 20th century would also unleash a series of events that would culminate in the beginning, at least, of the decline of Christianity in the West? The Armenian Genocide, the Russian Revolution, the Holocaust, and increasing liberalism from the 60s onwards. In the West, Christianity has, in less than 50 years, gone from being the pillar of society to what many now regard as, as an irrelevance. So does it have a future? And if we, if it does, do we care? Well, Alistair McGrath, for one, would answer yes to both these questions. Alistair's an ordained minister, who's also Professor of Historical Theology at Oxford, and is the author of a new book entitled The Future of Christianity, in which he argues that its decline in the West is mirrored by its dynamic growth in Africa and South America. Rather than an imminent demise, he says, we're likely to see a radically changed Christianity in the future, with all kinds of implications for societies around the world, and I can't wait to talk to him about such phenomena as the McDonaldization of Christianity. Alistair joins me now from the BBC studios in Oxford. Welcome.
Thank you. Welcome.
Only too many people would gladly argue that Christianity has no future. You obviously don't believe that. But before we look more closely at what its future might be, let's go back to your thesis about Christianity's decline in the West. What reasons do you offer for it?
Well, I think there are several reasons, and one of them, I think, is a growing scepticism in the West about claims to truth that are made by any religions. I think that one of the things we have seen very much in recent years is people becoming very, very sceptical about anybody who offers anything, whether it's politicians, whether it's religious teachers and preachers and so on. So I think there's a growing...
So Doubting Thomas would be the most popular disciple.
That's a very good way of putting it, yes. Mm. I think that that's certainly part of it. But there are other things as well. I mean, very often in the West we're told that there's a decline in religion. And that's partly true. There's certainly a decline in what you and I would probably call organized institutional religion. But there's a huge explosion in what we'd probably call spirituality, which is, you know, my...
Do you call it spirituality
desire,
or do you think of it as McDonald's faith?
I like the word spirituality because it implies there's a side to human nature which is simply not satisfied by material possessions and so on. There's something more that people are questing for, and they may not find it in institutional churches, but they may find it in some private religious experience of their own, which may actually be very close to traditional Christianity, but doesn't have this institutional linkage with the church anymore. And that, I think, is one of the big issues that faces Christianity in the West, how to relate this growing personal interest in matters of religion with the institutions of the church, which increasingly, I think, are being seen as having little relevance for many young people these days.
Now, Alistair, let's go back to one of the great conflicts of the 20th century, which I think exposed weaknesses in Christian dynamism. And I'm thinking not simply of any Christian complicity in Holocaust, but of the fact that German Christians, and Christianity was an overwhelmingly dominant belief system in Germany, were incapable, or chose to not to resist with much energy, the rise of Nazism. Surely that's another factor, another consideration in Christianity nosediving, at least in Europe.
Yes, I think this is a deeply worrying thing. If we look at the German church situation in the 1930s when Hitler was rising to power, we see this very, very worrying assumption that somehow there's a direct linkage between Christianity and German culture. And therefore, anything that helps to revive and restore German culture is something that Christianity ought to go along with. And certainly there were Christians like Dietrich Bonhoeffer who say, no, 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 the Bible, Jesus point us in a very different direction to this. We don't go with the flow. We try to stand out, to go against the stream. They were very much in a minority. And I think that experience of the German churches is deeply troubling because it means that there are many Christians in the West who are just quite happy to go with the flow of whatever is happening in culture at the moment. And inevitably, there'll be times where they have to stand up and say, no, this needs to be resisted.
You know, Alistair, when I was a whippersnapper and I had made my first trip to London, which of course every Australian has to do, it's a bit like Muslims going to Mecca, I dropped in on that nice little cathedral where you crown your royals. And the thing that astonished me was that the artists, the poets, had this little dark nook and cranny, you know, in one of the one of the alcoves. But the main thrust of that church is to exalt Imperial Britain. The great tombs are for generals and admirals and the great marketers of empire, which reminds us that over the millennia, religion of all sorts has been very closely allied, hasn't it, with imperialism?
Well, religion has always been allied with states, and as states begin to develop imperialist agendas, you're absolutely right. And certainly, if you look at Britain during the 19th century, I mean, I think Britain saw itself as trying to civilize things, and maybe we can allow them that conceit. But certainly, looking back at it, I mean, it was a time of an alliance between Christianity and the British state, which I personally would want to say is very much open to questions. But you're quite right. We see the same phenomenon, for example, in various Islamic countries, where there's a very close alliance between religion and the state and so on. But also, of course, and I think it's worth making this point, in the Soviet Union and elsewhere, there was a very close alliance between atheism and the state. So every state
needs ideology. Yes, my mob are not without guilt. I have to acknowledge the truth of that. Now, let's look at a bridge you build. Or rather, it's a very interesting part of the book. I was quite surprised to find you using Star Trek as a method of analysis. Can you tell me what Gene Roddenberry has got to do with your thesis?
Yes, well, I was a great Trekkie in my youth, and in fact, I still enjoy watching the movies. But Star Trek has changed hugely over the years. If you go back to the original episodes where Gene Roddenberry, its creator, who was a very enlightened humanist person, I mean, his basic agenda was to say, when we go and civilize the galaxy, which of course that's what they were doing, you know, one of the things we're going to eliminate is poverty, disease, and of course, religion. And if you watch some of these early episodes, you know, you may find that some of the more backwards inhabitants of the galaxy had religious views, but I can tell you that none of the Star Trekkies would. And Roddenberry was
very much I've never actually noticed that, but you're right, aren't you? Because Captain Kirk and the rest of them were secular humanists.
Secular humanists, very sophisticated and enlightened, and religion is very, very backward, and we want to change things. But then Roddenberry went and died. And what happened, of course, was that the program kind of got released from the 1960s, 70s time warp it had fallen into and began to adapt to the America of the 90s. And suddenly,
with all its religiosity,
we find that religion's back, you know, in a big way. Religiosity, spirituality, Native American spiritual guides are in. And in many ways, what the program was doing simply was catching up with where American culture was. Because what we've seen between about 1960 and about 2000 is this reaction against a kind of de-spiritualized culture to a rediscovery of spirituality, which doesn't necessarily mean a rediscovery of Christianity, although it might do, but it's very much saying there is something more to life, more than the world, than pure materialism can give us.
But it's a bit of a trade down, isn't it, when you go from the Virgin Mary to Shirley MacLaine. Nonetheless, tell me where fundamentalism fits into all this. I'm thinking Christian fundamentalism on this particular occasion.
Sure, yes, sure. Well, I mean, fundamentalism does have its movements, you know, all over the place. But in Christianity, it really began in the 1920s when many American Protestants began to feel that American culture was drifting away from its anchorings to historic Christianity and began to try and devise all kinds of strategies to change things. And I suppose the simplest strategy was to circle the wagons and get very, very defensive and say, in effect, we're going to react against culture, we're going to defend ourselves. Wherever culture is going is wrong, and our historic role is to resist this. And you could say that fundamentalism basically is a very strongly counter-cultural movement trying to reclaim an older phase in its history where religion really mattered.
Well, let's flip the coin now. One of my regular guests, whenever he's in Sydney, he pops in for a chat, is ex-Archbishop Spong, and he reminds me of a very strong thrust in English theology right from the time of the book Honest to God, where, in effect, almost everything is thrown out of Christianity by progressive thinkers, and there's very little religion left.
Well, that's right, and in many ways what you could say is that we have two wacky extremities here. We have the fundamentalists on the one hand and people like Bishop Spong on the other, and somehow there is a middle way. I mean, the amazing thing about Bishop Spong...
You sound like Tony Blair.
No, the amazing thing about Bishop Spong is he's in effect saying, look, if we throw out this and this and this and this, people will come flocking back to the churches. But I have to say, I see no sign of that in his own diocese before he retired whatsoever.
Yeah, but you do point out in the book that, if you like, the hyperactive American face, where there's really every form of physical exuberance, is in fact packing them in.
Well, that's right. And in America, and actually to some extent in Australia as well, we see these things called mega churches beginning to take off, which actually are, I think, probably very significant for the future of things, because mega churches are very often churches that are so large that they do not need a denominational substructure to support them.
What do you mean by that? I'm sorry.
Let me explain. It's quite an interesting point. Supposing you have Presbyterians in North America. They've got lots of individual churches. And a Presbyterian denomination gives those individual congregations their identity and resources them. With the mega churches, where you have a church of 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 members, you don't actually need a denomination to support you. You can do it yourself. And in America, in fact, what we're seeing is some of these churches beginning to emerge and beginning to reach out and establish satellites in other cities, and in effect making a transition from being a mega church to a denomination in their own right.
This is like Walmart religion, isn't it? More than McDonaldization.
Yeah,
so you've got the huge shopping mall approach to faith, which is putting out of business the local stores.
Well, and to take this further, you've got a form of Christianity which is saying we need to actively market faith. In other words, we need to say, look, what are people looking for? Here is Christianity. How can we present Christianity in a form that is attractive to the marketplace, bearing in mind the marketplace changes from year to year? So it's a very interesting development. For North Americans, the ultimate consumer product these days is Christianity.
Now, Alistair, you're right. It is happening in Australia. Is it happening in the UK? Or is the Anglican Church simply sinking slowly like the mighty Wurlitzer?
Well, I think the Church of England does things with immense graciousness. And so if it is sinking, it's sinking very, very gracefully. But I fear it is, actually. You're quite right. There are, of course, very significant exceptions to this. There are areas of the Church of England where we're seeing very significant growth. And again, it tends to be on this American megachurch model. You mentioned you made some pilgrimages to London, and one of the places that you may have seen is Harrods Department Store in Knightsbridge. And
oh, every Australian goes straight to Harrods.
Absolutely. But if you just
genuflected the name.
If you turn the corner, you come to a church called Holy Trinity Brompton, which is a church which is attracting amazing numbers of people and is, in fact, establishing church plants left, right and center. And for many people, that actually may be the future of British Christianity.
Describe what's going on within this church, please, Alistair.
Holy Trinity Brompton is a church where you go in on a typical Sunday. I've never been able to get in because the queues are so long, but if you go in, the congregation is typically in its 20s. They're typically young, urban professionals, bankers, lawyers, this kind of thing. And the kind of Christianity that's being offered there is very charismatic, very upbeat, very attuned to where these people are, and they love it. And more than that, they go out, they tell their friends, they bring them. The church is now too small to take them all, so what they've had to do is, in effect, establish little satellite congregations all over the place.
Any modification to teachings? Have they abandoned some of the Ten Commandments, like thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's BMW?
No, yes, or thou shalt not make millions. Yes, I think, I mean, there are some points where traditional Christian ideas are being de-emphasized. I mean, I could give you one or two examples, but the more remarkable thing is that actually these growing congregations are in many ways very traditional indeed. And again, I find this contradicts what Bishop Spong says, who I think, if I could summarize him, is saying that to grow, you need to abandon traditional Christianity. For Holy Trinity Brompton and many other places, the key to success is not abandoning, but rather refocusing what traditional Christianity is all about.
The other night on the program, I was discussing the crisis in the US for the Catholic Church in regard specifically to nuns, with the mean age is now in the late 60s. Mm. But as Roman Catholicism sort of atrophies in the West, as you point out in the book, it's having a boom time in Africa and South America. And it's pretty much the Roman Catholicism of yore, isn't it?
Well, that's right. I mean, one of the amazing things we are seeing is this massive demographic shift whereby Christianity, which you and I tend to think of as being a Western religion, actually is heading south and heading east. And the growth areas are Africa, Latin America, but also Southeast Asia. And, you know, I wouldn't be at all surprised if we were to go to a big city like Sydney and find there very large and growing Chinese congregations, Korean congregations and so on, where actually they're ethnically quite distinct, but actually they're developing a form of Christianity which mirrors what's happening back home and is growing.
So the diasporas also spread a different form of Christianity.
They do. They develop forms of Christianity which in many ways are in line with the Christianity of their homeland, for example, Hong Kong or Singapore or Korea, but actually very often is adapted in some ways to the Australian context. And what you very often find happening is that outsiders, in other words, normal Australians, will begin to come along to these churches and catch a glimpse of the vision that drives them and wonder if they could replicate this somewhere else.
Now, Alistair, as you must be aware, Spong has got quite a large following. Whenever he's on the program or involved in a discussion on matters religious, we get inundated with approving emails and phone calls. So what we're looking at is demographic complexities, aren't we? Where, you know, there's that coexisting with some of the more exuberant forms of Pentecostal faith. We've got the Christianity is becoming ever more complex. It's a term that almost means nothing and everything.
Well, that's right. And certainly, if you were to ask me to describe a typical Christian service these days, I would have great difficulty in being able to even begin to sketch that. There is such diversity. But actually, interestingly, again, if you look at some modern American sociologists, what they will say is that one of the reasons that Christianity is actually beginning to grow again in many places is the sheer diversity of Christian options. And, you know, if I'm put very, very crudely, if you don't like a traditional Anglican evensong, and some do, many don't, then actually that's not a problem because there are so many alternative visions and representations of Christianity on offer that somewhere there's going to be one that will really excite you. And so diversity actually is a means of ensuring that wherever you are, there's a form of Christianity that actually is pretty close to what you're looking for.
Well, what you're describing is bad news for the big brand faiths and for established hierarchies, but not necessarily bad news for the faith overall. In one of your previous books, which has an impressive title, Intellectuals Don't Need God and Other Modern Myths, you wrote that it is in the marketplace of ideas, not the seminar rooms of universities, that Christianity must fight for its life. Is Christianity not fighting for its life at your university within your historical theology teachings?
It certainly is. What I was trying to say in that is that actually for most people, the real debates are not the debates between, Thomas Aquinas or Bertrand Russell or people like that, but actually the day-to-day issues of what is there that will keep me going from one day to another? The real issues that people will talk about in cafes and shopping malls, and really we've got to give answers at that level.
And we're right out of time. Challenges. No more answers, I'm afraid. But Alistair, thanks for your time. Alistair McGrath, The Future of Christianity, published by Blackwall Publishing. I was so caught up in that.